watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this
week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. We have a very full show this week that deals with changing paradigms both emotionally and physically, with waking up and coming home. We'll take a look at preparing for post-petroleum society with James Howard Kunstler, and War and the Soul with Dr. Edward Tick, and conclude with the underground history of education with more from John Taylor Gatto. Our first talk was given in March at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco.
And now it is my honor to introduce our speaker, James Howard Kunstler. He started out life as a writer doing mostly fiction. He's written 9 novels, I think, and 4 nonfiction books. But starting in the early 90s, he became very impressed with the decline of the urban landscape, and he began writing a series of articles for the New York Times Magazine. That culminated in his first of his books about the urban environment, which was called The Geography of Nowhere. And he's written other books, A City in Mind, including A City in Mind, and his most recent book is The Long Emergency. Jim Kunstler.
Thank you very much. It is a pleasure to be back in this beautiful city. 2 years ago in my book, The Long Emergency, I wrote that our nation was sleepwalking into an era of unprecedented hardship and disorder, largely due to the end of reliably cheap and abundant oil. We're still blindly following that path into a dangerous future, lost in raptures of infotainment, diverted by inane preoccupations with sex and celebrity, and made frantic by incessant motoring. The coming age of energy scarcity will change everything about how we live in this country. It will ignite more desperate contests between nations for the remaining oil and natural gas around the world. It will alter the fundamental terms of industrial economies. It will ramify and amplify many of the problems presented by climate change. It will require us to behave differently, and we are not paying attention. As the American public continues sleepwalking into a future of energy scarcity, climate change, and geopolitical turmoil, we've also continued dreaming. Our collective dream is one of those super vivid dreams that people have just before awakening, as the fantastic transports of the unconscious begin to merge with the demands of waking reality. The dream is a particularly American dream on an American theme, how to keep all the cars running by some other means than gasoline. And the dream goes, you know, we'll run them on ethanol, we'll run them on biodiesel, we'll run them on synthesized coal liquids, we'll run them on hydrogen, methane gas, electricity, used French fried potato oil, and so on. The dream goes round and round in fevered circles as each gasoline replacement is examined and found to be, in one way or another, inadequate. But the wish to keep the cars going is so powerful that round and round the dream keeps going. Ethanol, biodiesel, coal liquids, etc. And a harsh reality indeed awaits us as the full scope of the permanent energy crisis unfolds. The global oil production peak is not a cult theory. It is a fact. The Earth does not have a creamy nougat center of petroleum. The supply is finite, and we have ample evidence that all-time global production may have already peaked. Of course, the issue is not about running out of oil. This is often uniformly misunderstood. It's not about running out of oil, because there will always be some oil left underground. It just might not be worth using a barrel of oil's worth of energy to extract the barrel of oil that you want to get out. The issue is not about running out of oil. It's about what happens when you head over the all-time production peak and head down the slippery slope of depletion. And what happens is that the complex systems that we depend on for everyday life in advanced societies will begin to falter and to wobble and, in some cases, to fail. And the failures in each system will, in turn, weaken the other systems. And by complex systems, I mean the way we produce our food, the way we conduct manufacture and trade, the way we operate banking and finance, the way we move people and things from one place to another, and the way we inhabit the landscape. I'm going to try not to dwell excessively on the statistics of the oil situation, since I'm more concerned here with the implications for the everyday life of our nation of these things. But it's probably helpful to understand a few of the numbers. And some of these things are numbers that the public is completely not paying attention to at all. Oil production in the U.S., of course, peaked in 1970. That's what the OPEC embargo was all about 3 years later, when we discovered that in the rearview mirror we had peaked. And we're now producing about half of the oil that of what we did then. And our own production continues to run down steadily at the rate of a few percentage points of recoverable reserves each year. And it adds up. In 1970, we were producing about 10 million barrels a day, and now we're producing less than 5. And we consume over 20 million barrels a day. We compensated for that by importing oil from other nations. Today, the world is consuming all the oil that it can produce. And as global production passes its own all-time peak, the world will not be able to compensate by importing oil from other planets. Nor is there any real likelihood that new discoveries will be adequate to compensate for the losses as depletion increases. Discovery precedes production, of course, because you can't recover oil that you haven't discovered. Discovery of oil in the U.S. peaked in the 1930s. That was the heyday of finding oil in the U.S. And production started declining roughly 35 to 40 years later in the early 1970s. Discovery of oil peaked worldwide in the 1960s. And now the signs suggest that the world itself has peaked in terms of production. Discovery of new oil worldwide in recent years has amounted to a tiny fraction of replacement levels. In fact, we may be burning more oil just in our exploration efforts than we're getting from the new discoveries in the oil we find. Isn't that amazing? The oil industry has been dominated by what are called supergiant oil fields, sometimes called elephant fields. And the four of the reigning supergiant fields were discovered decades ago and are now in decline. The Burgan field of Kuwait was declared by the government of Kuwait to be in decline, past peak last year. The Daqing field of China is past peak. The Cantarell field of Mexico, the second biggest one ever found, is past peak. And finally, the Ghawar field of Saudi Arabia, the granddaddy of all the great supergiant fields. Together, in recent decades, these giants were responsible for about 14% of the world's oil production, and they are now in decline. All except Ghawar of Saudi Arabia have been declared officially past peak by their own governments, and Ghawar is showing clear signs of trouble, although Aramco itself doesn't say so. Ghawar has provided 60% of Saudi Arabia's production. Saudi Arabia's total production has been down 8% in the past year, despite a massive increase in drilling rigs and the incentive of relatively high prices. There's some question that they are manipulating their output by, for example, resting old fields that have been overproduced, but we really don't know what the story is with that. All we can tell for now is that their production is down 8% a year. Perhaps more to the point of how things will affect us directly very soon. Last year, the Mexican national oil company, Pemex, declared that its supergiant field was officially past peak and in decline. And as in the case with Ghawar in Saudi Arabia, Cantarell has been responsible for 60% of Mexico's oil production. Cantarell is now crashing at an official decline rate of at least 15% a year, and perhaps more. Mexico has been our number three source of oil imports after Canada and Saudi Arabia. And the crash of the Cantarell field means in just a few years, our number three source of imports will have no surplus oil to sell to the U.S. It also means that the Mexican government will be strapped for operating revenue. And you can draw your own implications, your own conclusions about the political implications of that. The North Sea and Alaska's North Slope were some of the last great discoveries of the oil era. Plentiful North Sea and Alaskan production took away OPEC's leverage over the oil markets. This led to the oil glut of the 1990s eventually, driving oil prices down finally to about $10 a barrel at the turn of the millennium. It's also what induced the American public to fall back asleep on energy issues, because it seemed as if cheap oil was here to stay forever and that all the disruptions of the 1970s were just a shuck and jive. Both the North Sea and Alaska are now also past peak and in depletion. Prudhoe Bay, by the way, proved to be Alaska's only giant, supergiant oil field. Several other key fields were discovered, but none of them were one-sixth the size of Prudhoe Bay. North Sea oil, which was jointly owned by the UK and Norway, was produced using the latest and greatest new technology for drilling. And guess what? It only allowed that region to be drained more efficiently and more rapidly. So now 57 of Norway's 69 oil fields are past peak, and the average post-peak decline rates average 17% a year, which is very, very steep. You know, it basically means 5-6 years they're out. Not to mention their ability to export. The UK's share of the North Sea has declined to the extent that England is now a net energy importer after 20-odd years of enjoying this fabulous North Sea bonanza that allowed them to suburbanize a lot of England. Russia, despite current high levels of post-Soviet-era production, peaked in the 1980s and may now be as much as 70% into its ultimate recoverable reserves. Iran is past peak. Indonesia, an OPEC member, is so far past peak that it became a net oil importer last year, as did England. Venezuela is past peak. Iraq and Nigeria are consumed by political insurrection. The companies developing Canada's tar sands have announced this past year that their costs will double. Their production costs will be double original estimates. In other words, whatever comes out of the ground there is going to be very expensive. Meanwhile, in the background, ignored by the U.S. media, an additional problem is developing on the oil scene. Net world production is going down by just under 3% a year. And this is just in the last year over year. It's not a very long rear view mirror, but that's what we're seeing. The more ominous thing is that total exports from the top 10 exporters are going down at a steeper rate than that. Geologist Jeffrey Brown, among the excellent technicians at the website theoildrum.com, writes that the top 10 exporters are showing a net export decline of 7% the past year, trending toward a 50% export decline over the coming 10 years. That means half of the oil that we're used to sending out to the importing nations will not get there. And why is this? Why? Because on top of production decline rates, nations like Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Venezuela are using more of their own oil at home. As their populations rise, they use more cars, more appliances, etc. They desalinate more water. This is all very costly in energy. And a few more background items. Most of the easy-to-get light and sweet crude oil is gone. We got that out of the ground in the run-up to the peak. We found that kind of high-quality oil in the temperate places on shore, in places like Texas, where it was easy to work, and the stuff was relatively close to the surface. And the remaining oil is each year proportionately made more of heavy and sour crudes that are hard to refine and yield, yes, less gasoline. Most of the refinery capacity in the world cannot process these heavy and sour crudes, and there is no world-class industrial effort being made to build new refineries that could process them. And most of the oil refinery infrastructure in the world is very, very old and rusty. In the U.S., most of it is 50 to 70 years old. Finally, most of the remaining oil in the world exists either in geographically forbidding places where it's extremely difficult and expensive to work, like deep water out in the ocean or in frozen regions, or else it belongs to people who are indisposed to being friendly toward us. The natural gas situation is equally ominous, with some differences in the technical details. And by the way, I'm referring here not to gasoline, but to methane gas, CH4, the stuff that we light our kitchen stoves with and run our home furnaces. And half the furnaces in America are run with natural gas. Natural gas doesn't deplete slowly, like oil does, following a predictable bell curve pattern. It simply stops coming out of the ground very suddenly, and then that particular gas well is played out. So you get the gas from the continent you're on, and to get it elsewhere by other means is very expensive and difficult. So that's the background on our energy predicament. Against this background is the whole question of how we live in the United States. I wrote 3 books previously about the fiasco of suburbia. There are many ways of understanding and describing this. I now call it the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. Why? Because it's a living arrangement with no future. It was designed to run on cheap oil and gas, and in a few years, we're not going to have those things. Having made those choices, we're now hobbled by a tragic psychology of previous investment, which is to say, we have poured so much of our late 20th century wealth into this living arrangement, this happy motoring utopia, that we can't imagine letting go of it or substantially reforming it. And we've compounded the problem lately by making this the building of suburban sprawl the basis of our economy. That's what the housing bubble has been all about. Roughly 40% of the jobs created since 2001 have been in bubble-related fields. The builders, the mortgage brokers, the installers of granite countertops. And if you subtract that from the rest of the economy, there's not much left besides fried chicken, hairstyling, and open-heart surgery. So we can see the tragedy of this and the tragedy of the housing bubble itself as it now begins to unwind. So what are we going to do about our extreme oil dependence and the living arrangement that goes with it? There's a widespread wish across America these days that some combination of alternative fuels will rescue us, will allow us to continue enjoying by some other means what has been called the non-negotiable American way of life. This wish is perhaps understandable given the psychology of previous investment, but the truth is that no combination of alternative fuels or systems for running them will allow us to continue running America the way we're running it now, or even a substantial fraction of it. We're not going to run Walmart, Walt Disney World, Monsanto, and the Interstate Highway System on any combination of solar or wind or hydrogen, nuclear, ethanol, tar sands, oil shale, methane hydrates, thermal depolymerization, or zero-point energy or used French fried potato oil, or anything else you can name. We will use many of these things in many ways, and we should use many of these things in many ways, but we are likely to be disappointed by what they can actually do for us. For instance, we're much more likely to use wind power on a household or neighborhood or district basis than to build these deployments of Godzilla-sized turbines in gigantic wind farms. The key to understanding what we face is that we have to comprehensively make other arrangements for all the normal activities of everyday life. It's a very long and detailed to-do list. The public discussion of these issues is impressively incoherent. The failure of the collective imagination is reflected especially in the poor job being done by the mainstream media covering this story, especially in particular the New York Times, which does little besides publish feel-good press releases from Cambridge Energy Research Associates, the oil industry's chief public relations office. These days, the only aspect of these issues that we are willing to talk about at all is how we're going to keep running the cars by other means. And we have to get beyond this obsession with how we're going to run the cars. because the future is not just going to be about motoring. We have to make these comprehensive arrangements for all the other activities of daily life. We have to grow our food differently. We have to do farming differently because the industrial model, the Archer Daniel Midland, Monsanto, and Cargill model of agribusiness will not survive the discontinuities of the long emergency. This system of pouring oil and gas-based fertilizers on the soil in order to grow the cheese doodles and the hamburgers. As oil and gas deplete, we will be left with sterile soils and farming organized at an unworkable scale. And many lives will depend on our ability to fix this. We're going to find out by the hard way that we can't afford to dedicate our croplands to growing grains and soybeans for motor fuels. And a Pennsylvania farmer put it to me eloquently about 3 weeks ago when he said, "It looks like we're going to take the last 6 inches of Midwest topsoil and burn it up in our gas tanks." The disruptions of the ethanol mania are already thundering through our system. Last month, there were riots in the center of Mexico City because so much Mexican corn is now being diverted to ethanol production in the U.S., and the poor people living on the economic margins can't afford to pay for their staple foods of corn and tortillas, etc. And so you can see, by the way, how this is a tragic extension of our obsession with running all the cars. In the years ahead, farming is going to come back closer to the center of economic life. It will necessarily be done at a more local and smaller scale. And it presents huge problems for us in land reform. Okay, another thing. We're going to have to move people around from place to place differently. It's imperative that we restore the U.S. passenger railroad system. No other project we could do right away would have a more positive impact on our oil consumption. We used to have a railroad system that was the envy of the world, and now we have a railroad system that the Bulgarians would be ashamed of. The infrastructure for rebuilding our railroads for this great task is lying out there, rusting in the rain, waiting to be fixed. The project would put back to work scores of thousands of people in meaningful jobs at every level, from labor to management. It would benefit people in all ranks of society, and fixing the U.S. Passenger rail system doesn't require any technological leaps into the unknown. The technology is thoroughly understood. The fact that from end to end of the political spectrum, there's no public discussion about fixing the U.S. passenger rail system shows how unserious we are. It's very, very important to get to this task. And there's another compelling reason to undertake this great project of repairing the U.S. passenger rail system. It's something that would restore our confidence, a way that we could demonstrate to ourselves that we're competent, that we're capable, that we're realistic, that we can meet the challenges of this energy-scarce future. And it will inspire us to get on with the other things that we have to do. And by the way, it's terribly important that we electrify this system. All the other advanced nations have electric railroad systems, which you can run on other things. You can control the source point, carbon emissions, and so forth. Terribly important. We're going to have to move things by boat. But we've just finished a 50-year effort of taking apart most of the infrastructure for maritime trade in this country because we've gotten the idea that harbors and riverfronts are only for parks and bike trails and condo sites and festival marketplaces and rock and roll band shells. We're going to have to put back the piers and the warehouses and even the crummy accommodations for the sailors. And we're going to have to move a lot more stuff by water or our commerce will suffer. And if we use trucks at all, we're probably going to use them in the final increment of the journey, if we use them at all. And our leaders in business and politics have not yet wrapped their minds around that new reality. We are probably in the twilight of happy motoring, as we've known it. The automobile is going to be a diminished presence in our life. They may not disappear, but it will become self-evident that our extreme dependency is at an end, and it will then become a political problem because as a larger and larger class of people cannot afford happy motoring, they're going to be full of resentment and grievance about it, and especially about maintaining and fixing highways that only an elite can enjoy. We're going to have to make other arrangements for commerce and manufacturing. The national chain discount stores that took over American retail in recent decades are not going to survive the discontinuities of the long emergency. Their business equations and methods of operation will fail In particular, their remorseless cancer-like drive toward replication and expansion. They will lack the resilience to adapt due to their gigantic scale of operations and narrow profit margins. The so-called warehouse on wheels composed of thousands of trucks circulating incessantly around the interstate highways won't work in an economy of ever scarcer and more expensive oil. Not to mention the 12,000-mile supply lines to the factories of Asia, which we have tragically become dependent on for all our household goods. We're going to have to check all our assumptions at the door about the global economy. Now, thanks to Tom Friedman and other cheerleaders, we've adopted the idea that globalism is a permanent condition of life. I think we'll be disappointed to learn the truth, that globalism was a set of transient economic relations that were possible at a particular time of special conditions in the world, namely half a century of cheap energy and of relative peace between the great powers. And those conditions are about to end. And many of our far-flung economic relations that we've come to rely on will go with them. The U.S. and China are contesting for the world's remaining oil resources. China has outstripped its own dwindling supply. China has gone all over the world in recent years systematically making contracts for future delivery of oil with other nations, including Canada, by the way, as it ramps up the tar sand production. And I want to remind you that there's such a thing as the Monroe Doctrine, an American foreign policy position that essentially forbids nations outside the Western Hemisphere from intruding in or exploiting affairs in this part of the world. And it may be an old and arrogant policy, but I predict the time will come when the United States will invoke it in order to preserve our access to Canadian oil supplies. And if and when that occurs, what do you suppose that will mean to our trade relations with China? How many plastic wading pools and salad shooters will Walmart be ordering then? We're going to have to rebuild our own retail trade and commerce and manufacturing in this country. And it's important to recognize the damage that the national discount chain stores have already done in destroying local commercial economies. If you travel around the nation as I do, you see places in Pennsylvania and Alabama and Michigan and Oklahoma and Connecticut and my own home place of the Upper Hudson Valley, places that now look like former Soviet backwaters. They've become so destitute and deindustrialized. The desolation is just out of this world. In destroying local retail infrastructures, the chain stores wiped out a whole merchant middle class. These were the people who sat on local school boards and hospital boards and sponsored Little League baseball, who employed their neighbors and had to behave decently toward them because they had to live with them, and they had to treat their neighbors decently in matters of trade because they had to live with them. And there were people who uniformly took care of at least two buildings in their town, the place they did business and the place they lived in. And these were the people who were the caretakers of our communities, and the extermination of this class of citizens has been devastating. I think the truth is we're going to have fewer things to buy in the years ahead. The blue light special orgy of retail is going to fade into history, and shopping will retreat into the background of life. Consuming things will not be our sole reason for living. The role of finance as we know it today will be severely challenged by the long emergency. Declining energy supplies will have one particularly grave implication for industrial societies, that they can no longer take for granted the 3-7% annual growth in gross domestic product that has been assumed to be normal throughout recent history. In fact, the energy picture, the dwindling of a particular, extraordinary, one-time, special resource, oil, implies a general contraction of productive activity. And our expectations for growth are vested in tradable paper certificates like currencies, stocks, bonds, and other instruments that represent our confidence that society will produce more wealth. And the idea that this increase can be enjoyed in the form of profits and dividends. And what happens when that consensus about our expectations falls apart and we no longer believe that these certificates will produce 3-7% of growth in wealth a year for us? So we can see the beginning of this process right now in the unwinding of the home mortgage sector. This recent experiment in the abolition of moral hazard, in the suspension of norms and standards in lending, in the fobbing off of risk, is climaxing in one of the great debacles of modern economics. It was based on the idea that immense numbers of promises for future payment could be bundled into bonds, resold, and parlayed to leverage ever more abstract casino-like bets masquerading as investments. This is anything but investment in future productive activity. It is now being discovered that at the foundation of all this jive finance lies bundles of broken promises, non-performing loans, as they're called. And it remains to be seen how this mortgage and housing fiasco will play out. But I think it will be one of the major events leading to an overall loss of presumed wealth for American society. And it is likely to infect global finance as well. The key to all our everyday activities in the future is scale. We're probably going to have to live more locally than has been the case. And I think we can state categorically that things organized at the giant scale, whether they're corporations or universities or chains of stores or schools or governments, are going to run into trouble. School is another thing we're going to have trouble with. The giant centralized school districts that were all super organized in the last 30 years in order to save administrative costs that are served by the gigantic fleets of yellow school buses collecting all the pupils from the 50-mile pupil sheds. We built the same flat-roofed one-story buildings in Florida and Minnesota, and we're going to discover that they're hard to heat without cheap natural gas. And we're going to have to do something about that. What we're going to do, we have no idea. My guess is that the remedy for this is going to be a self-organizing process growing out of the homeschooling movement as it aggregates into larger units. The destiny of higher education, of course, is another troubling thing. The gigantic universities are exactly the kinds of institutions that are going to prove unwieldy and unsupportable in the long emergency. College will cease to be a mass consumer activity, and it may become if it survives at all, an activity for a much smaller economic elite. And, of course, it will generate resentment and grievance because of this. The question of class relations, per se, will be affected by our energy situation, since it is necessarily linked to the economy. The long emergency is going to produce a lot of economic losers, a group I call the formerly middle class. They will lose jobs, they will lose incomes, and they will never get them back. They're going to be full of grievance and anger and resentment and bewilderment at the loss of their entitlements to the non-negotiable American way of life, including home ownership and affordable, happy motoring. And they're liable to express their unease and unhappiness politically. We'll be lucky if they do not turn to demagogues who promise to mount some sort of campaign or another to restore the entitlements of suburban life. And such a campaign will be an enormous exercise in futility and a gross waste of our remaining resources. We, I think, can be secure in understanding that our cities are probably going to contract. Giant cities of the late 20th, early 21st century are products of a cheap oil economy. We are not going to be able to operate them at the scale that they're at now. The ones that are composed of suburban fabric are going to be the ones that get in the most trouble. And some of them are going to have, like Phoenix, will have additional problems with water and producing food locally on top of energy problems. The good news is in Las Vegas, the excitement will be over. For the past two decades, I've been associated with the New Urbanist movement, and the New Urbanists were architects, planners, and developers who recognized the tremendous liabilities and weaknesses of the suburban development pattern, and they've been campaigning to reform the way we build things in this country for 15 years. Their methods are consistent with what we're going to need in the decades to come, to refashion human habitats that have a future. The great achievements of the New Urbanists was not in the new projects and new towns that they built, not the seasides that have been built. Their great achievement was to retrieve lost knowledge from the dumpster of history, a whole body of principle and knowledge and methodology and skill necessary to design places worth living in. And this was the knowledge we threw in the garbage in 1950 in order to become a drive-in utopia. We threw it away thinking that true urban design and artistry could be replaced with statistical analysis and traffic engineering. Big mistake. And what we managed to do was build a land full of scary places that turned us into a nation of scary people. But this was the final tragedy of suburbia. We put up thousands of places that aren't worth caring about, not understanding that when we had enough of them, that we might be left with a nation that was not worth defending. So there you have a comprehensive to-do list of the things that we have to do, the challenges that we have to meet in this what will be a permanent global oil crisis. Growing our own food locally, restoring our railroads and other forms of public transit, rebuilding local networks of commerce and economic interdependency, reorganizing education, and building places that are worth living in. We cannot assume a seamless transition between where we are at now and where we're going. In fact, it's more liable to be turbulent and disorderly. We can't assume that technology alone will rescue us. In fact, one of the big delusions in the media, especially today, but generally in the American public at large, is that technology and energy are the same thing, and that if you run out of one, you just plug in the other. Technology and energy are different. They're not the same thing, and they are not interchangeable. When I go around to colleges, I'm always asked at the end of my talks, can you please give us some hope? Because the college kids find this a discouraging picture of where they're going to spend most of their lives. And I have to tell them, I cannot give you hope. Hope is something that we have to supply for ourselves. We are the generators of hope, especially the young people are the generators of hope, and they generate the hope by demonstrating to themselves that they're capable, that they're competent, that they are realistic and brave enough to greet the circumstances that reality is sending our way. And then by demonstrating that they're capable of accomplishing the things necessary to meet those challenges. That's how we develop hope. We develop hope by developing confidence in our ability, not by being passive, not by wishing, not by expecting to get something for nothing, which has been the pattern of the broad American public imagination for the last several decades, but by developing true skills and true courage in the face of what reality is really sending to you. So we've got a lot to do. We've got to put down the iPods and get busy. There's no time for hand-wringing, whining, or whinging. And as Yogi Berra once remarked, our whole future's ahead of us. So that concludes my formal remarks, and I guess we'll get on with the questions. Thank you.
I'm Kerry Curtis. I'm the chair of the club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum, and I will be moderating today's audience question period. We have a ton of questions here, Jim, so let's begin. The first one has to do with the politics in the U.S. and how politics is likely to evolve or devolve in response to the pressures that will come with the decline of oil and so forth.
Yeah, well, they're liable to become more delusional, because that's generally what happens when a society is stressed. The higher the stress level gets, the poorer the thinking becomes collectively. That's something that we can expect, and we better be prepared for that. You know, we better be prepared for the American public to demand a campaign to sustain the unsustainable, which, as I said in my formal remarks, will be a tremendous exercise in futility and a continued misinvestment in the future, a misinvestment in things that have no future. You know, right now, around the United States, there are many plans for building gigantic new interstate highways, this gigantic NAFTA highway that's going to begin to be constructed in Texas. You know, we can't afford to make these kinds of investments. They're very poor choices.
Several members of the audience have questions about specific forms of energy other than oil, such as oil sands. You mentioned that the Canadian source of petroleum and nuclear. A lot of proposals to build more nuclear energy, and then also conservation. You don't hear the big oil companies talking much about conservation. You at the beginning of your talk, you said you didn't think any of those measures or collectively they could make up for the decline at petroleum sources.
No, they're not going to make up for it. We're still going to be required to make other arrangements for all these major things, whether we like it or not. We'll probably use these things, and they're probably going to disappoint us. However, the quality of the public discussion about this stuff is just terrible, deplorable. You know, we may actually need to run nuclear energy. We don't know yet, but we're not having any kind of public debate about it. There are a lot of valid arguments not to do nuclear. There are a lot of valid arguments to be afraid of nuclear and to shy away from it. There's also the idea that we might not be able to keep the lights on in 20 years if we don't do it. So I'm not coming down necessarily either one way or the other on that, but what I am saying to the public is, where's the public debate about that? Because we better start it. Because if we are going to build reactors, it takes 10 years to get them built. As far as conservation goes, do we want daddy or mommy to tell us to conserve? You know, the American public needs to demand this in one way or another. My guess is we probably won't demand that until we really feel the pain of price increases. That hasn't quite happened yet. Part of the crux of this issue is we really have a short window of opportunity to get going on this in a coherent and comprehensive way without inviting a great deal of political and social and economic turbulence and destruction. You know, a lot of the kind of social turbulence we face will be very destructive. It will destroy everything from our ability to do any of these projects to the sheer knowledge base that we possess. You know, there are things that we know how to do now that we may forget in the future if we live in a very disorderly society in which institutions are badly damaged. So these are the kinds of things we need to be very worried about.
Earlier you mentioned that that politics is likely to become even more delusional. And in that spirit, these two questions come along. One is, how much will the huge cost of the Iraq war accelerate this long emergency? And given U.S. desperation to secure energy resources, do you think that the U.S. will attack Iran? And if so,
I'll take those backwards. You know, a lot of the people who correspond with me are very nervous about Iran. I, for one, am not really that exercised about it. I don't think it's immediately on the menu. I would be surprised if it is, unless the Iranians do something really crazy. Our misinvestment in Iraq, I think, is going to be have tremendous consequences. In the first place, we've already succeeded in exhausting and bankrupting our military to a significant degree. Sooner or later, we're going to have to leave the Middle East. You know, our purpose in the Middle East really is pretty simple. We went there apart from having, you know, apart from the trauma of 9/11 and having to strike back at some Arab entity, in this case Saddam Hussein, because he was the best candidate for this. Apart from that, the whole purpose was to modify and influence the behavior of the major players in the Middle East, namely Iran and Saudi Arabia. Sooner or later, whether it's a year or 36 months or 5 years, we're not going to be there anymore, and we're going to have to withdraw. We're going to lose our influence in that part of the world. We're going to have to withdraw into the Western Hemisphere. What then will we do to run Walt Disney World and Walmart when we lose our influence in these other parts of the world where they have oil? We're going to not be able to control events in that part of the world. Now, that's a strictly sort of pragmatic and strategic view of the situation, but I think that's where we're headed, and those are the kinds of questions we have to ask.
I'd like to remind our listening audience on the radio that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to James Howard Kunstler. His topic is the long emergency. What are your thoughts, Jim, about the ecological footprint concept and the metric that goes along with it in terms of assisting policyholders and decision makers?
Well, I'm not all that entranced per se with statistical analysis as a way of understanding our world generally. There was a very influential article that came out in the New Yorker about 2 years ago. I forgot the name of the author, but the article said essentially Manhattan was the greatest model for green sustainable living because you could cram so many people into the footprint of a building, that is the square feet. In 10,000 square feet of a building space, you could cram 50 stories of people living in apartments. Okay, so that was one statistical way of understanding sustainability, but in my view, it was completely wrong-headed. because we're not even taking into account the fact that skyscrapers may not be sustainable building types. You know, if we don't have a cheap and reliable natural gas supply, methane gas, we're not going to be able to heat those skyscrapers in New York City. So, you know, the statistical view of things can lead us down pathways that are very misleading and eventually have terrible consequences.
You mentioned the decline of the U.S. passenger rail system as regrettable and the desirability of building that back up again. What about the future of air travel?
Very good question. I fly now and again, and I've noticed over the last 5 years an incredible process of decrepitation out there in the airlines. It seems, you know, one particular airline that will go unnamed that I flew in the last 10 days twice seems to have three employees in the whole airline. You know, they fly the planes, they clean the planes, they give you your boarding pass, you know, they check your luggage in. The airlines are like the canaries in the coal mine. The great airline fleets that are owned both by the private companies and the national airlines, we're not going to change the hardware. We're stuck pretty much with the hardware that we've got, the Boeings and the Airbuses and the Embraers that run on liquid hydrocarbon fuels. They're either going to run on liquid hydrocarbons or they're not going to run. And also, you know, the economic equation that goes into that has to work right. The liquid hydrocarbon fuels have to be cheap enough because it's about 40% of their operating costs. So if aviation fuel goes up to $5 a gallon or $6 a gallon, what happens then? My guess is that commercial aviation is not going to be with us that far into the future except as one of those elite activities, and that even that may not continue. You can't get from Columbus, Ohio, the capital of Ohio, to Cleveland on a train. That's crazy. You can't get from Atlanta to Nashville. We've got to do better.
One of the problems that's been more and more pronounced in recent decades is the maldistribution of wealth. The haves have an increasingly high percentage of income, and the have-nots have an increasingly small proportion of that. Do you see this long emergency that you're talking about exacerbating that phenomenon?
Historically, what happens in cases that are like this is you get people, especially given our problem with food production and having to make a shift now between industrial food production of cheeseburgers and cheese doodles and going back to local, smaller scale farming that will require more human attention, there's a whole prospect for a group who retains wealth and land and a group of dispossessed, underemployed, starving perhaps, new class of people who are going to be very desperate. And those are the kinds of conditions historically that produce revolutions. They produce seizures of property. They produce what is called the circulation of elites, in which one group of elites is thrown out and another group rises and takes their place. These are, you know, historical processes, and we've seen them happen before. And so you can probably state categorically that it's very dangerous when you see this trend building and building, and we should be concerned about it.
Here's a question from an audience member who says, "My favorite local farmer is struggling to stay afloat. What can he do to keep his small local organic farm in the black until our policies and consumer demand catch up?"
Well, I wish I could pretend that I was an agronomist, and I'm not. And I can't give your friend really useful advice, although there are people who are doing farming that we see doing it in a different way that they can do profitably. We went about 3 weeks ago to a very large convention of the Pennsylvania Association of Sustainable Farmers. And it was a very impressive group of people for a number of reasons. One was a lot of them were really young. They were young people who had gotten into farming. They were really healthy looking. You know, they didn't look like these lumbering brutes that I see in the airport concourses, you know. They were healthy, they were young, and they were really intelligent. And they were very, very interested in what they were doing. And that, to me, was a tremendously important sign that there's a cohort of people out there who are interested in this important issue and doing something about it and doing it happily and doing it energetically. And it was a real shot in the arm for me to see that. There are organizations all over the U.S. for sustainable agriculture, and they're full of energetic, healthy, smart young people.
That was James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency and other books, speaking last March. He has a website and blog, which is worth checking out at kunstler.com. That's KUNSTLER.com. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. Next, I'm pleased to offer you one of the most profound talks I've ever presented here, which comes to us thanks to Voices for Global Justice in Los Angeles. The speaker is Dr. Edward Tick.
Dr. Tick is a Ph.D. and expert on post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. A practicing psychotherapist for more than 25 years, he is a nationally recognized authority on the psychological, spiritual, historical, and cultural aspects of war. Dr. Tick specializes in transformational work with survivors of severe trauma, including war veterans. He has held various positions with and is a clinical member of the American Academy of Psychotherapists and the American Holistic Medical Association. Dr. Tick began treating Vietnam veterans in 1979, before PTSD was a recognized diagnosis. He established the Soldier's Heart organization for the sole purpose of helping veterans with PTSD and teaching family and friends how to welcome soldiers home with compassion and understanding. Edward Tick's book, War and the Soul, Healing Our Nation's Veterans from Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, was published in 2005 and won the 2006 Award of Distinction from the International Communicators Awards Program. Dr. Tick gave a talk on War and the Soul, Healing Our Nation's Veterans from Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder on March 30, 2007 in Santa Monica, California.
Thank you all very, very much for coming. Of course, we are in war, and it's a terrible time for all of us and for all the world, and it is of utmost importance that we speak about it openly, honestly, and truthfully. I've been traveling around the country talking about this war, all wars, the wounding that inevitably comes from all war, and what we can do about it for our service people, for their families and our communities. And sometimes people want to know my politics. And whether my presentation will be anti-war, I'm not focused on that. Rather, what we need to do is to tell the truth about war. That is its own protest. Probably most of you, all of you, have heard the famous statement that actually came from a California congressman at the turn of the last century, the first casualty of war is truth. We have the burden and the responsibility of returning truth to war. All we need to do is speak the truth about it and let people make up their own minds and their own decisions after that. But the best protest against war is simply to tell the truth about it. So that is what we will try to do together, and that is what our veterans are trying to do, and that is what post-traumatic stress disorder is trying to do. Not break down into an individual stress and anxiety disorder, an individual psychological affliction, but rather tell the truth and get the rest of us to listen. So we will do our best to do that together tonight. I'd like to begin by invoking spirit to help us in a very particular way. We don't know how to think about war. We don't understand it. We have so much false mythology that surrounds it, that I have had to turn to other cultures, other times and places to understand it and to understand the possibility of healing war. and of course our Native American brothers and sisters who do come from warrior cultures and spiritual cultures know utmost about the nature of war and what it does to people and how to help the warriors come home and the entire society heal from war. So to begin tonight's presentation, I would like to use a song of Sitting Bull. Sitting Bull, you all remember, was the great Lakota warrior and chief. He didn't consider his status as a warrior to be the most important thing he did for his people. He considered his role as medicine chief of the warriors, medicine chief of the Hunkpapa Warrior Society, to be the most important position he held of many in his tribe. Well, when our white armies were invading and taking the Lakota lands, the Lakota unified for the first time, and the only time in their history, under a single chief. They hadn't done that before. They practiced local representational and participatory democracy rather than turning things over to one supreme commander, but they had to under these conditions of invasion and terrible duress. And so they elected Sitting Bull. And when he became chief, he was a great poet and singer and songwriter also. And as in many warrior traditions, Sitting Bull used the arts of peace to balance the arts of war. He composed this song on the occasion of becoming Grand Chief, Supreme Chief of the Lakota people. He said, sang, "You tribes, behold me. The chiefs of old are gone. Myself, I shall take courage. You tribes, behold me. The chiefs of old are gone. Myself, I shall take courage." I want to share a little of why I choose this song to begin the presentation. You tribes, behold me. We are a broken society in so many ways, and what we call post-traumatic stress disorder is not just an individual disorder. It is a social disorder and a spiritual disorder. Our veterans, when they come home, are saying, "Behold me, look at me, see what I've gone through." Half of the homeless on our streets in America are veterans. You know how many of them still wear their uniforms and their medals? They want to be seen. "Behold me. This is who's come home. This is the condition we're in." So Sitting Bull cried to his tribe to behold him, and our veterans and their families are crying to us to see them. And post-traumatic stress disorder, among other things, is the scream from the soul to be seen in its anguish. Then Sitting Bull said, "The chiefs of old are gone." Well, he meant it literally. The chiefs were being wiped out. And as in other wars, the aggressors, we are, particularly targeted the chiefs, the leaders, the medicine people, the spiritual people. Because if you can break the spirituality in the community of another people, then you perhaps can conquer them. Sitting Bull was lamenting the loss of the old chiefs, but he was also talking about the ancestors. The chiefs of old are gone. He was appealing to the ancestors, to the spirits of his people, to help him serve as a medicine man, as a warrior, as a leader, to protect his people. And finally, "Myself, I shall take courage." He realized difficult, profoundly challenging position he was in, and he declared his willingness to accept the burden and the responsibility to try to fulfill this position and take care of his people, preserve their ways. And, of course, anyone who has come out of hell, as our veterans and their families have, needs spiritual help from the chiefs of old and needs to have immense courage and not collapse along the path to transformation and healing, which is possible. Another thing we learn from our Native American brothers and sisters is, well, how to hold counsel, how to live in community and tribe, and the right way of performing some of our rituals so that they are true healing experiences for the entire community. So in powwow, The first thing that happens is that the spirits are honored and called forth, and we call that all the spirits to help us using Sitting Bull's name and song.